This episode is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. As the new year rolls in, we're bombarded with messages about transforming ourselves, but how about a different approach for 2024? Let's celebrate what's already great about us. So let's talk therapy. It's a powerful tool, not just for overcoming challenges, but for recognizing your strengths and making meaningful changes. Therapy teaches you to cope positively and set sound boundaries. It's for everyone who wants to sharpen their mental well-being. So if you've been thinking about therapy, but keep giving yourself excuses not to start, here's a little nudge to give BetterHelp a try. It's completely online, tailored to your schedule. You fill out a questionnaire, get paired with a licensed therapist, and remember, you can switch therapists anytime, no extra charge.
Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/Jordan today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/Jordan.
This episode is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. As the new year rolls in, we're bombarded with messages about transforming ourselves, but how about a different approach for 2024? Let's celebrate what's already great about us. So let's talk therapy. It's a powerful tool, not just for overcoming challenges, but for recognizing your strengths and making meaningful changes. Therapy teaches you to cope positively and set sound boundaries. It's for everyone who wants to sharpen their mental well-being. So if you've been thinking about therapy, but keep giving yourself excuses not to start, here's a little nudge to give BetterHelp a try. It's completely online, tailored to your schedule. You fill out a questionnaire, get paired with a licensed therapist, and remember, you can switch therapists anytime, no extra charge.
Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/Jordan today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/Jordan.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. Our feelings control us. The thinking brain and the feeling brain, seemingly forever at odds with one another. Rationality used to be the highest of human virtues. Now it seems the pendulum has swung perhaps too far in the other direction. Many of us seem to be convinced that our feelings are all that matter. This thought trap lodges us firmly into a quagmire where we get stuck in one identity, unable to see past our own values and impulses. The problem is that we puny humans actually need that conflict of values to derive meaning. I know it might be too early for all this philosophical BS, I get it. So let me rephrase this. We're all starting to become way too friggin' soft, and we're running headlong into a crisis of meaning because of that. In this episode, my friend and one of the best-selling authors of the decade, in order of importance, Mark Manson, joins me to discuss the research behind this phenomenon and, as always, what we can do about it to correct course. Despite the subject matter, or perhaps because of it, this is a fun conversation with a good friend of mine, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. If you want to know how I managed to create networks that contain superstars like Mark Manson, well, I'm showing you how to do that for free, no upsell, change in life stuff. This is what it is. Biggest thing that's ever changed my life, these networking skills. Go grab the course. JordanHarbinger.com/course is where that's at. In the meantime, here's Mark Manson. One thing that's great is you're good at writing like people think, like the inner dialogue. Is that something you do that on purpose, obviously?
Yeah, well, I try to write the way I think, you know, and the way I talk, which is kind of like just a dude in a bar.
Yeah.
So I think people resonate with that.
That's very like writer, a guy with a typewriter of you, right?
Well, it's funny. I do feel like a lot of writers try to create their voice. You know, they try to sound a certain way. And for me, it's just, I just try to match the voice in my head.
And that's funny. I wondered about that because I do see other authors trying to do that. And you can tell they're trying because it sounds like an MLM, like a multi-level marketing sales pitch, but in book form, where it's like a kid's trying to sell. Someone's trying to sound hip to 20-somethings to increase their downline. So they're like, you know, I'm going to show you my whack-ass dance moves, and you're just going to have to deal, okay? And I'm like, okay, this is... Nobody's really... That's not a real internal dialogue. Yeah, it's like, hello, fellow kids.
Yes.
Yeah.
Was that? It's from The Simpsons, right?
That is Steve Buscemi in
some movie.
Yeah, some movie. Yeah. Hello, fellow kids. He's got a skateboard.
Yeah. Well, who knows? Maybe that's my future.
Maybe. They're like, hey...
Bring me back in 10 years. I'll be like, hello, fellow kids.
Yeah. Like, hey, look, we just want you to recreate that one big hit, man. Just keep doing that. Don't mess with the recipe.
Don't
grow as a human or a writer at all, if you can avoid it, please.
Not profitable.
No. I can see the temptation in that, though, right?
Yeah.
Like, musicians have to do that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and there was tons of temptation to do that with this as well. Like, you know, subtle art was so huge. Like, it's...
Toot your own horn. No one's going to judge you.
Yeah. I mean, so it's at the time of this recording, I think it's around 7.5 million copies.
That's bonkers.
Yeah. And it's been number one in 13 countries. And it's just, it's like a once a decade type book.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, obviously everybody's like, dude, just do it again. I mean,
yeah.
The cover.
Right. Just put an F-bomb in the title, use the same
little
blotch.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I had to fight them. You know, I kept telling them, I'm like, look, I'm not just going to cram fuck into it just to have fuck into right. it. You know, it needs to have its own theme, its own idea, its own, like,
yeah.
its own purpose. Like, I'm not just going to try to, like, keep beating the same horse. So I think we found a happy medium. You know, I'm super happy with the book. I feel like it's an extension and a maturation of what Subtle Art was.
Yeah.
I think it's deeper. It's more thoughtful. I think it's a better book. And then they got their fuck in the title. So
yeah. So they're like, all right, well, good. It'll be fine. Yeah. We put an F-bomb in the title. And that's, so, that's the reason it sold so many copies
yeah,
before.
Yeah, exactly.
That and because it was orange. So yeah. We just need another type of orange, like a blue, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whenever, you know what I noticed? When people go, oh, what's the title? I say, oh, it's called Everything is Fucked. And they go, oh, okay. And I said, it's a book about hope. They universally, they start laughing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know if you did that on purpose. I thought that
absolutely.
Was pretty funny. Yeah?
Absolutely. Because I think what a lot of people... You know, I've always told people the most important word of the title, Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, is actually subtle. Mm-hmm. Like, what makes the title good is subtle art, you know, because fuck is just such a bold, like,
yeah,
gaudy, like, ugly, in-your-face word. But then when you have the subtle art, it, you know, it makes you chuckle. You're like, yeah. Oh, yeah, there is a subtle art to not giving a fuck, I guess.
Otherwise,
you know?
It's just chucking the glass at the wall and smashing things.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a little bit of irony there. So, you know, I went for the same thing with this. It's, you know, we all seem to feel like everything in the world is fucked right now. So it's a book about hope.
So aside from, like, it raining money, not probably not literally, but who knows, 7.5 million copies, what opportunities have you gotten from that create, because if it's once in a decade, you got to have some once in a decade opportunities other than just being like, cool, I can retire now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm doing Will Smith's book.
Yeah, no bet.
Which that's the huge one.
Yeah.
I'm doing a cool project with Audible. So I'm doing kind of like, I don't want to call it coaching, but it's like, I basically talk to people about their relationship problems in the studio, and then we record it. And so we build a book and a theme out of that.
Great.
So that'll probably come out end of this year. So there's been some pretty cool projects that have come down the pipeline. The funny thing is, and this is actually something that is just like confusing everybody in the industry, is I have still gotten zero mainstream press. And
really?
I
didn't even think about that.
Until Michelle Obama's book came out, I was the best-selling nonfiction book of the last 3 years, probably the last 5 years, and not a single publication has written anything about me. No TV show, no radio show.
That's a nut punch in a weird way, where it's kind right? of like, it's kind of like,
yeah.
If it, there's some sort of jock analogy here, right? It's like people are going, you know what? We don't like this guy or this title or this book or this idea for some reason, so we're just going to be like, no.
But you know what's
You're
crazy?
Not the cool kids club.
Like, even so, like, you take Jordan Peterson.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've sold like twice as many books as Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, speaking of unpopular ideas, right?
People hate him.
Yeah.
He's been in every newspaper, yeah. every TV show. You know, so it there's just, and I talk to my agent or I go to my publisher and everybody just kind of shrugs. They're like, we have no idea. Like, this is just kind of unprecedented. So it's a really strange thing.
Yeah, that's. I'm kind of annoyed for you because I know what it feels like to be overlooked for something where
yeah.
you're like, someone will go, I'm the number one something something podcast. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You started this 6 months ago. I've been doing this for a dozen years. You're 7,000 places below me. But cool that you got your friends with the editor of Vogue, like, F you.
It's like the guys yeah. who put a 20-page ebook on Amazon
yeah.
and put the price at $0.
Right.
And then they become, you know, number one in, like, religious humor coloring books
right.
or something. And they're like,
yeah.
I'm a number one bestseller.
Yeah.
You
like,
know, it's...
You're like, oh, does your agent have it framed in her office? Because mine does. Oh, wait a minute. It was on Amazon.
Oh, wait. You don't even have an agent. Oh, yeah. Never mind.
yeah. Now we sound like dicks. We might have to cut that out. Hey, or it's just a good clip.
Hey, you and I have put in our years.
That
sir.
Is for sure true. Yeah. That is for sure true. We've known each other for a long time. And
yep.
this book, which is the point of this interview, which we'll get into in a second, it starts off cheery. It's got an Auschwitz story in there, communist occupation of Poland.
Yep.
And it concludes with the idea that human existence is ultimately meaningless. So it's a fun read.
Buy it today, folks.
Available. It's a bestseller on Amazon. What is this idea of the uncomfortable truth? That's kind of the first
sure.
major concept of the book. Why is that important?
So it, ultimately, this is a book that argues against nihilism. I feel like there's a lot of nihilism or nihilistic tendencies growing in our culture.
Can you tell us what that means? Because I'll be honest, I have to look stuff like that up.
Sure. So nihilism is basically the belief that life is pointless, so you should just do whatever the fuck you want.
Right.
And I think there are a lot of pressures in our culture that are kind of pushing us that way. And I think as a result, we have a lot of crises of meaning, a lot of crises of hope that happen. And so my take with the book, I did two things. One, I started with the Auschwitz story. And I did that intentionally because I want to kind of set the stage for the rest of the book. Like, people are coming to this book, they're probably buying it because they're really, really upset about something they saw on Twitter. Mm. And I want to, like, immediately give perspective and be like, hey, I know you're really upset that, like, you know, what's his face, like, you know, went to trial and didn't get convicted or whatever. But, you know, here's a guy who was in Auschwitz.
Right.
And by the way, 6 million people were murdered. You know, yeah. So just like set the stage, like, all right, everybody chill out. And then from there, you know, the first thing I introduce is the uncomfortable truth, which is this fact of life, which is that in the grand scheme of everything we know about the universe, everything we know about the world, like, we are so tiny and insignificant. Each of our actions and behaviors are so tiny and insignificant in the grand scheme of things, that it's really difficult to ignore the fact that whatever we do with our lives is probably not going to have much consequence, yeah, or any consequence.
Do you think about that a lot? Because it's like people go, what would you do if you only had 2-3 months to live? And I'm like, oh my God, I have so many podcasts I got to record. And they're like, no, you don't understand. You're going to die. And I'm like, yeah, but this is what I like doing. And they're like, no one's going to remember this in like a couple decades or 100 years. And even with a book as big as the one you just had, it's like, do you ever think like, okay, this is going to outlast me, but how long?
I mean, 100 years, probably nobody will remember.
Right.
So
it's like so disappointing. Because wouldn't you love to go down like Plato where you're like, nope, I'm forever now, I'm good.
Yeah, I would love that. But I mean, the funny thing is even Plato, you know, 10,000 years from now, nobody will know who Plato was.
There might have even been a gap where people didn't care about that, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you think about it, and I'd love to know, was there like a 5,000 year period where people were just like, or about the ancient philosophers or the old stuff, like thousands of years or hundreds and hundreds of years where people are just like, we don't care about that.
So there's actually, to plug another book really quick, there's a great book by Steven Greenblatt called The Swerve. Mm-hmm. And it's this insane story in the 1400s about how the Roman philosopher Lucretius was rediscovered. So basically when the church formed, Lucretius was like, staunchly atheist, said there's
persona non grata, yeah.
Yeah, no, there's no afterlife. And he came up with the theory of evolution. He hypothesized, you know, the atoms. He had like all these scientific theories that didn't come around for 2,000 years. Like, he was on top of that. And the church destroyed all of his books. And there were only like a few dozen left in the world. And there was some guy in the 1400s just happened to walk into a monastery and find one of them. And it, like, completely changed the course of European history.
Wow. And now they're like, we told you to burn these.
Yeah.
This is why.
The Pope is like, damn it.
Well, I'm just going to keep one of these in my room, he said.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
But so back to the uncomfortable truth. I mean, the uncomfortable truth, I think it's not some, we've all thought about it before. I don't think many of us dwell on it. But anybody who's been particularly depressed at any point in their life, mm-hmm, it's the uncomfortable truth is always front and center. It's like, why bother? What does it matter? Nobody cares. We're all going to die anyway.
Yeah.
Like, we've all been in that place before. And so the only way we get out of it is finding things to hope for, is finding these visions of a better future or a better life that we believe are valuable or important, and that we also believe that we are capable of pursuing or achieving. And so the only way to escape the uncomfortable truth is to develop a sense of value and importance and then push yourself towards it.
And so we use that to achieve progress, hopefully, in society. And then we end up with the paradox of progress, which, as you put it, which is something that I guess I was subconsciously thinking about, because I was like, how are people so upset about all these things that are really trivial?
Sure.
And I'm sure every person who's getting older probably has that realization at some point. I mean, I'm 39 and I'm always like, wait, you're upset about what now? Like, I get teenage angst where it's like, she posted this picture of me and everyone saw it and I'm embarrassed. Like, I get that. Your world is small. But you see adults doing this where... And the idea is the wealthier and safer we are, in fact, the more likely we are to be super depressed, commit suicide, and like end things. And it's like, by the way, this is going to be a very uplifting show, people, as you can tell so far. But
everything is fucked.
Right. A book about hope. Is it because the more we have to lose? Or is there something else going on here?
I think that's part of it. The more we have, the more we have to lose. I think also the more we have, the more complicated those visions of hope become. So one of the examples I give in the book is that there's a thing in academics called the Easterland paradox, which is basically they find that people in poorer countries are generally have better mental health, are happier, or more content with their relationships and their lives.
Yeah, you hear that and you're like, how dare you?
Yeah. And then in the richest countries, you know, suicide rates go up and depression, anxiety, all these things. And it's basically if you're like a subsistence farmer in India, that vision of hope, that purpose that you have in your life of like what a better future is, it's really simple and obvious. It's like, grow more food. Mm-hmm. I just need to grow more food and things will get better. And that gets you up every day. There's no ambiguity around that. But then once you have a society with like tons of opportunities and you've got all this education and there's 18 different career paths you can choose from and you've got... You're connected to like 2,000 people on social media who you're constantly interacting with and talking to. Suddenly those visions of what a better future could be get very murky and confusing. And a lot of us just get very, we give up essentially. It's like, well, I don't, shit, everything I think is good, there's somebody online trashing it. So I don't know what to think anymore.
Yeah. Plus, it's like, do you become a lawyer? And then your mom is happy. Do you become a writer? And then like, hopefully you can make a living, but that's what you like. But everyone tells you it sucks and it's a bad idea. And then your friend wrote something and nobody liked it. And then your other friend wrote something and it sold well, but then he still wasn't happy. So where are you going to end up? Meanwhile, this other guy's like, I just want to make sure my kids don't die.
Yeah. And like, plant corn.
Yeah.
Feed my kids, you know?
Yeah.
And he's happy, you know? He feels good about it. There's a lot of stress that comes with an abundance of choice. And it's, I think that stress wears down on us psychologically.
I know that to be true for me. I mean, I remember very recent, this is like embarrassing to admit, but I don't care. That's the whole point of the show, I guess. It's like, I remember having like really, being really distraught that like my Instagram wasn't growing fast enough. And then I realized after a lot, way too much thinking that I didn't actually care about that at all.
Yeah. It's so easy to get sucked into that vortex. Like that I had one of those recently. I sent out an email to my email list with the subject line, what if Hitler did yoga? And, sure enough, like 20 angry people were like, super offended, can't believe you made a joke about Hitler, blah, 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 like you're an awful person. And I was like, all right, it's time to set these people straight. You know, and I'm like super into it, super angry. And I started like writing all these replies. And I was like, what the fuck am I doing, man?
Yeah. Like, you're like, first of all, somebody should be answering these emails for me.
Yeah. And I'm like, dude, I have like 500,000 people on my email list.
Yeah.
And I'm like going to give up my entire morning and be pissed off all day because like 12 people, you know, sent me an angry email.
I'm so relieved that you also do this kind of shit.
It's impossible. Like, you don't even notice. You don't even know. You just get sucked right into it.
Yeah. So. Like, I'll do that with like Twitter. And then I'm like, this is why I only check Twitter every 2 weeks, damn it. And then I'm like, wait, I like the other 99 people that engaged with me yesterday were awesome.
Well, and then it spoils everything. Mm-hmm. So, because then it gives you this false perception of like, well, everybody on Twitter is an asshole, and so fuck Twitter, you know, and when that's not true. Like, it's there's some weird threshold where if there are just enough bad apples, it just spoils the whole bunch for everybody. And I think that happens with email. It happens with social media. I think it happens with news media. Like, I know that, like, you know, I'll probably read 10, 20 articles a day. But if I read one that's just like stupid as hell and like pisses me off, I'm like, the fucking media these days can't read anything anymore, you know? Yeah. And it's hard to like stop ourselves from doing that.
in part because of the feeling versus the rational brain. There's other stuff going on here.
Sure.
But it's a good, it's a kind of a shitty segue, but I'm going to go with it anyway.
We'll go with it. Yeah. We'll go with it.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Mark Manson. We'll be right back. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. And to learn more about our sponsors and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. If you'd like some tips on how to subscribe to the show, just go to jordanharbinger.com/subscribe. Subscribing to the show is absolutely free. It just means that you get all the latest episodes in your podcast player when they're released, so you don't miss a single thing. Now back to our show with Mark Manson.
I actually talk about this a lot on the show, the feeling brain versus the rational brain. And it's extremely useful as a concept because a lot of us, we think, okay, you know, I'm doing this because this is the best decision. It's like, really? You buying a vintage Corvette is the best
on
possible. On credit is the best possible use of this invest. Like, oh, you're investing in jewelry or Rolexes. Okay, watches do appreciate sometimes, but usually not, probably. Let's talk about this because I think you said it really well. The thinking brain is not in charge. That rational brain is not really in charge. Our emotions are driving the car. It's just that the thinking brain is the supporting character that imagines that it's the hero.
Yeah, which is, that's the Kahneman quote. So I create, in chapter two, I create this kind of silly metaphor. And then I basically sat down, I'm like, I want to create like a ridiculous metaphor and see if I can like keep it going over like 40 pages. And so I created this idea, like, imagine your consciousness is a car and you have a thinking brain and a feeling brain. And most of us, our assumption is that the thinking brain is driving. The thinking brain is like being very responsible and like, oh, it's time to go buy milk. And and the feeling brain is in the passenger seat screaming and yelling and being really obnoxious and pointing at things out the window. And it's like your thinking brain's job to be like, shut up, feelings. We've got to go buy milk. And that's kind of just what we assume about life. You know, it's if we see somebody who has a drinking problem, we're like, oh man, that guy's not disciplined. You know, he needs to like dampen his impulses and put his feeling brain in place. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, when you look at all the psychological literature, the feeling brain is actually driving the car and the thinking brain is drawing the map. And so ultimately the thinking brain has no control. Like you can't, anybody who's ever tried to like lose 10 pounds by reading a book has experienced this. You cannot think your way to doing the correct action. Ultimately, the action needs to feel good in some way for you to continue doing it. And so in that sense, any issue of like self-control, self-discipline, procrastination, underachievement, like these are all fundamentally emotional problems, but we attack them as if they're logical problems. We think if we just learn all the benefits of, you know, low carb diets, then we'll stop eating carbs. It's like, no, you need to find a way to emotionally enjoy whatever habit you're trying to take on for yourself.
Right. And the idea that the thinking brain is drawing the map is your emotional brain will go, okay, we're going to eat a bunch of crap. And then thinking brain goes, okay, I got to make this make sense, even though we just said we're going to lose all this weight.
Sure.
So what I'm going to say is, I'm going to eat all this crap because then I won't want crap because I'll have been full of eating all this crap. So I'll be over it.
Yeah.
And that will then help me lose weight. And the emotional brain's like, yeah, whatever, man. Sounds good. And just
sounds
keeps
good.
Eating. And the thinking brain's like, all right, hopefully I can kind of keep it together.
Yeah. And it's, I remember, so I smoked for a number of years. And I remember there was like there's a running joke with all smokers is that every single smoker is trying to quit at all times.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like it was,
sure.
You know, I'd be hanging out with like a group of smokers outside a club or something. And somebody would be like, man, I'm trying to quit. And like everybody would look up and be like, yeah, me too. Like it's just a constant thing. But you know, every smoker goes through this where they're like, okay, I'm quitting. But man, I had a stressful day at work. So
yeah,
a cigarette would help me. Oh shit. I've got that meeting coming up. I really need a cigarette to like calm down for it. So I'll quit after the meeting,
right.
You know, and then there's always some rationalization. And then next thing you know, like 2 months have gone by and you're still smoking a pack a day.
Right. Oh my gosh. I don't even remember. I remember smoking in college and afterwards and then being like, this is dumb every single time. And I remember people in law school who are like really rational, smart people are like, wow, people still smoke. And then 84 people are like, yeah, whatever. And we're just all looking at each other like, we know this is stupid.
Yep.
It's like smoking, drinking too much. What is it? Tanning is one thing that I think a lot of women especially are like, oh, I'm just doing it twice for my trip. It's like in May, it's January.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? And we do this everything with eating food. It's just this is how it's not just bad habits. It's our entire life. And you wrote a piece in the book here. They went from recognizing and honoring their feelings to the other extreme, believing their feelings were the only thing that mattered. And this has been particularly true for white middle class yuppies who were raised under the classic assumption, grew up miserable, got in touch with their feeling brains at a much later age. Because these people never had any real problems in their lives other than feeling bad, they erroneously came to believe the feelings were all that mattered, and the thinking brain's maps were merely inconvenient distractions from those feelings. Many of those people called this shutting off of the thinking brain in favor of their feeling brain's spiritual growth and convinced themselves that being self-absorbed twats, you can say it, twat. And it's fine when you say it that way. The other
sound
way,
like you're from Boston.
Right. The other way is rude. This way is fine.
Twats.
It brought them closer to enlightenment when really they were just indulging the old feeling brain. It was the same old clown car with a new spiritual looking paint job. It's like you see me, Mark. You've seen this before, though. I mean, this is like all over the internet, and especially in our, I guess, our adjacent space. I don't consider you or me in that space at all. But that's kind of like what a lot of our old friends or like people we know are kind of doing. Like.
Yeah, I rip self-help pretty hard
in
this, especially in this chapter, because I think there's a little bit of a toxic cycle. So first of all, the first part of that quote, one of the problems I talk about is that people tend to either completely like suppress and shut down their thinking brain, you know, so they're just all feelings all the time. They don't think anything through. Or they try to shut down their feeling brain. Mm-hmm. So they like block and suppress their emotions in situations and try to be logical, but even though they can't. What happens is they just become unaware of actually where they're driving. And so the goal is to, like, a healthy, mature psychology is when you train the brains to talk to each other. The problem is that they speak a different language. Mm-hmm. You know, the thinking brain thinks in thoughts and the feeling brain thinks in feelings. And so you have to learn how to listen to your feelings, respond with thoughts, and then listen to the feelings that respond to that and just kind of get this back and forth going. One of the things I talk about in the chapter is that I feel like a lot of self-help has taken people who, you know, if you're like a white middle-class yuppie type who grew up in the Western world, this is true in a lot of cultures, you know, I know a lot of Asian cultures as well. Like, you were basically taught to just beat your feelings into submission.
Yeah.
You know, you had a duty to do X, Y, and Z. You had to go finish school and you had to get good grades and you had to make a bunch of money. And it's like, who cares how you feel? You just shut it off.
Yeah.
And what happens is obviously that makes people miserable. And then once they're into adulthood and they realize how miserable they are, they get in touch with those feelings. And it's extremely liberating to like realize like, oh my God, I've been angry all this time and I just like never admitted it to myself. Or holy shit, I've been like so sad and upset with, you know, my relationship with my mother and I never allowed myself to realize it.
Yeah.
And there's this huge liberation that comes with that. But people mistake the liberation of their feelings as their feelings being superior or more important to their thoughts. And so there's this whole kind of subgenre in the self-help world where it's just all feeling brain all the time. It's taking like disgruntled lawyers and doctors and pissed off insurance adjusters and putting them in a seminar room and having them like shout into pillows and scream and cry and hug each other and telling themselves that this is somehow profound or like they're becoming spiritually grown. And it's like, no, you're just acting out. Like, you're basically being a child.
Yeah, and you rip open those wounds for the benefit of the company that's running the seminar, because they're like, hey, everybody feel like crap? Okay, good. we just had you, like, talk about how you're angry at your parents, and they both pass away and never reconciled that. Our advanced course, which conveniently starts in 3 days,
and it's $10,000.
Is 10 grand. We're going to go through the best self-help stuff in the world to repair all this stuff that you ripped open. And I'm like, there's a woman who's been crying for three straight days in the corner of this room. Because I've done these seminars, right? Sure. Like, and they're not fun. They're not, you don't feel good afterwards.
Yeah.
I did it and I was shocked and dismayed at how manipulative it all really was. Yeah. It all really seemed salesy. And I talked about this on the show before. And there are women and men in the room who are crying for like the entire time. And you go, this person needs therapy like right now. This wound that we ripped open on her is so serious. Yeah. And like the hug from the stranger she met 2 days ago, who's like lives three states away, this is not going to make her feel better. No. She is really, really in need of psychological
help. She needs her thinking brain to engage those feelings.
Right.
Like that's the problem, is once you rip open those old wounds, those childhood traumas, you need to use your thinking brain to sort through the meaning and redefine the narrative of like what actually happened to you. But if you're like shutting down your thinking brain and just feeling all the time, you never actually create new meaning for yourself. You never create new meaning for your life. You just exist and wallow in that pain for as long as, you know, somebody keeps telling you to.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's
what a quagmire that is.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mess. And so, I mean, I just take some shots at the self-help world.
Yeah,
and,
well, we have that in common. I like that. That was one of my favorite parts of the book is, look, somebody else. Because one of the problems that I have with the whole thing is sometimes I look around and I go, oh, crap, I'm the only person that's like, this is ridiculous. You know, I'll look around, and this is could be metaphorical or real for real in that room. I'm like, so this is BS sales crap, right? And the other person's like furiously taking notes. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I don't want to ruin their experience. And I'll look around and like in this room with 300 people, there'll be like one guy who's like a surgeon or a doctor who's more analytical. And I'll go, so what do you think? And they're like, some of it could be a little bullshitty. And I'm like, yeah, I think like most of it is. And they're like, yeah, I kind of want to leave. And I'm like, yeah, like, me too.
Let's leave together.
Because they don't want to go like, this is a bunch of crap. And then it's like, this person is harming my experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they want to remove people like that in general.
Sure. Yeah. You know what's funny? And I've never understood this, but like the touchy-feely woo-woo self-help types have always loved my work. And I have no idea why, because I just shit all over it. But they think I'm one of them.
Yeah.
For some reason. And I used to get invited to these conferences sometimes, and I actually did one once where it was over in Europe. They flew me over to Europe. They didn't really tell me a whole lot. They just said, oh, we just want to like interview on stage and, you know.
Fireside chat.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, except everyone's naked and high on LSD, but whatever, yeah, it'll be fun.
Well, it's not too far off.
Oh, no.
So I get there and, you know, it's like the whole event, it's like there's like cuddle breaks and and people are doing these like weird tantric vision things, and I'm just like, oh, okay, I'm out of place. And it would always be so awkward, because then I'd get up on stage and they'd start asking me stuff. They're like, oh, so, you know, tell us about your spiritual growth. And I'm like, what the fuck is that? Like, and then the audience would hate me.
Yeah.
They'd be like, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Why is he here?
And why is he still wearing pants?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He's like, why isn't he hugging anybody? This guy's an asshole.
You're like, the title should have given a little bit of this away, but you know, that's cool if none of you read the book.
Yeah, right.
You just saw it on a show. Your friend had it, also didn't read it. Saw it on the bestseller list. Yeah, that's cool. Thanks for the trip to like Frankfurt, though. That is weird. But you know what it is? It's people, kind of to your earlier point, people are taking the meaning out of, they want to see this. So they read this book and they're like, this makes me feel this way that I don't really agree with. Oh, well, my thinking brain's going to write this as, oh, this book is challenging me, and that's what we need. And this is all satire. He must mean the opposite of what's going on in here. So let's invite him to the conference and then we'll find out what Mark Manson really thinks. And it's like, oh, what was on the labels? What's inside the jar? Oops.
Yeah, it's like they think I'm like I'm a self-help ninja. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I secretly believe all the woo-woo stuff that they believe, but I'm just putting on this like hard act to reach the masses.
Right.
You know,
yeah, appeal to the mainstream audience.
No, I think it's just a bunch of bullshit. Like, this is based on like real research.
Yeah.
This is based on like real psychology
and experience. Because I don't know how many people know this. It's a little embarrassing for both of us probably at this point. But we were in that dating pickup artist scene back 10 plus years ago.
Yep.
On the same message boards, knew all the same people, talking about our field reports or whatever on like online email lists. We went through all that stuff where it was like, oh, let's dive in hard to all of this. And then some of us came out the other side going, wow, that was not the solution. Yeah. I even thought you moved to Brazil. I was like, that's a good move because everybody down there, like you can meet tons of women down there and you can. And I know that there were guys that were like moving to Brazil to be like photographers and it was a little creepy. And I was like, oh, Mark must be doing that. And then you came back and you were like normal and had a wife. And I was like, oh, just kidding. He grew up down there. That wasn't supposed to happen.
I don't even know what to say to that. Jordan.
There's a lot in there to unpack.
There's a lot to unpack there. Let's just say I never knew you thought of me that way.
No, I mean, not really though, but I thought like, oh, he probably moved to Brazil to like escape with all this BS that we're doing here.
I mean, I traveled all around the world.
Yeah.
And I was a single guy, so I was partying, meeting girls in different countries. And, you know, that was fun. But yeah, I mean, that whole industry and scene, you know, I wrote my dating book in 2011, Models Attract Women Through Honesty. And that was kind of like my farewell project to that whole industry. You know, it was like, hey, you guys are all a bunch of like fucked up, manipulative assholes. Here's like an honest way to do the same thing you guys are trying to do. I'm out. Peace. You know? And part of traveling was also to just get away from that.
Sure.
You know, it was, I knew a lot of people in the industry and I didn't want to be around them anymore. Like it was like a very toxic group.
Online, it seemed kind of cool. And then you met all of them in person and you just went, whoa, no thanks.
I mean, it's
not all, many.
Many, yeah. I mean, I think looking back, it's such a weird thing to look back on now because it was super creepy and weird.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the impetus for most of us getting into, like, it was just genuine self-help, like or self-improvement. Like, that was the drive, you know? It's like I had a girlfriend who I thought I was like boyfriend of the century, and then, you know, she just dumps me and leaves me. And so it just destroyed my understanding of like what relationships were, what women were like, you know, how I was supposed to be. And so I felt like I knew nothing. And that was the only group of people that were like offering some sort of answer.
Yeah.
So
yeah, and that's what makes it attractive, which is a little dangerous if you find the wrong sort of seminar guru, whatever it is. I mean, how many nice guys did we meet in that industry that were then completely horrible because they were like, oh, my guru told me I have to be like totally horrible and mean.
Yeah.
And like never be vulnerable.
Oh, yeah.
And like, if she likes
women
you, like,
and come up with stories that didn't actually happen.
All the time.
And, you know, like it was really. And I remember the first time I read some of that stuff and I actually went. There was only like the only time I ever went out to a bar and like tried these like tactics or whatever. Mm-hmm. I just felt like such a scumbag like immediately. And then I noticed within an hour, I was like, wow, girls are much nicer to me when I like don't do this stuff. Mm-hmm. So maybe I should just not do it, you know? But anyway, that's a tangent.
Well, a little bit, but not necessarily, because it sort of goes into your Newton's laws of emotion here. I don't really want to go through all three.
Sure.
I think that they're great in the book, and I want to make sure that we move on to some other topics as well. But one of the third law is your identity will stay your identity until a new experience acts against it. And that's, so our values aren't just sort of collections of feelings. Our values are stories. And so these negative self-help experiences can actually, I don't know if they mutate our values, but they certainly tell us that we need to have different ones that don't make us happy.
Yeah. So anytime an experience happens to us, our thinking brain, like an experience is essentially either something pleasurable or painful.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's painful, a negative emotion will emerge. And if it's pleasurable, a positive emotion will emerge. And our thinking brain has to construct a story or a narrative about ourselves that explains that emotion. And this is why like childhood trauma fucks us up so much, because when you're a child, your thinking brain is still very poorly developed and you don't understand like why things happen to you. So if you are hurt in some intense way as a young child, the story you construct will be very basic of like, I'm a bad boy, or
right,
nobody loves me. And once that story is constructed, it, like, your identity is kind of like a ball of yarn that starts getting wrapped up when you're a child, and like, it keeps wrapping and wrapping and wrapping, and like, the closer, the earlier it happens in your life, like, the further into the center it is, like, the more you have to unravel to get back to it and look at it. So it's the only way these stories change is when we unravel all those narratives that we've constructed, look back at it and be like, oh shit, that thing that happened to me when I was four, it's not because I'm unlovable and, you know, a bad person. It's these things just happen to kids. Like, your thinking brain has to look at it, reevaluate it, put a new story to it, and then you have to go live out that new story. You have to like live as if that is your new story. And that's essentially how you quote unquote change yourself. I come from a Buddhist background, so I believe, you know, the idea of no self, like there is no, like, our identity is just this arbitrary thing that we make up and we believe in on faith. And what that construct is just this layer upon layer of stories that our thinking brain has constructed throughout our lives. And so at any point, you can pull one of those strings, look at it, ask yourself, like, what if this was not true? Mm-hmm. What if something else was true? And then depending on how that feels, how your feeling brain feels about it, you know, you can adopt that, and then you just tuck it back into the ball yarn. See, I'm keeping these metaphors going for a really long time.
Yeah, yeah. No, I like it. I do wonder, like, what would happen? This won't happen because you just have such a good loyal following. But, like, what if everything is fucked? So, like, it just does not do well. And Molly, your agent and the publisher are like, yo, did you email this to your list? And the list is like, yeah, this isn't what we wanted at all. We're all broke now. We're all buying Donald Trump biographies or something. Like,
yeah.
Then what does that do to your identity? Or like, because it's like, well, I still had that other thing. But then you have to at some point imagine, like, what if that never happened? Then crap, I'm like a failed writer.
Sure.
Like, that sucks, so instead of a best-selling author.
It would change my conception of myself. It mm-hmm. would change my identity. You know, it's like right now, my books, everything I've written has been a huge hit. And at some point in my life, I'm going to write something that's not a huge hit. And if I'm not prepared for that, see, you can already tell that I've already, like, analyzed this narrative in my own brain. Like, if I just told myself, I'm a hit author, everything I write, like, sells like fucking hotcakes. Like, the second something doesn't, it would cause an identity crisis. Mm-hmm. I would feel like I didn't know who I was anymore. That I, oh my God, you know, who am I? Am I good? Am I even a good author? All this stuff. I'd have all these questions. And what I'd have to do is kind of, like, look at my experiences, construct another narrative around it that my feeling brain accepted, that felt good and true to me. And then it would alter my identity. But I've already kind of done that work. I'm already, like, the narrative I've already constructed for myself is that one day, you know, maybe it's not this book.
Hopefully not.
Right? Hopefully not. one day I'm going to write something. It's not going to sell well. And, that's fine. It doesn't make me any worse of a writer or an author or a person. It's a very common occurrence in a lot of authors' careers.
Yeah.
So that narrative that my thinking brain has put together and feels good to my feeling brain, you know, it's kind of preempted that experience for me, and it's like prepared myself. That's a good kind of real-time example of like how this thinking brain, feeling brain thing works.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, Mark Manson. We'll be right back after this. Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers keeps us on the air. To learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/deals. And don't forget the worksheet for today's episode. That link is in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. And if you're listening to the show on the Overcast player on iOS, please click that little star button next to the episode. It really helps us out. And now for the conclusion of our episode with Mark Manson.
By way of practical application, and you write this in the book, the other way to change your values is to begin writing the narratives of your future self, to envision what life would be like if you had certain values or possess a certain identity.
Mm-hmm.
By visualizing the future we want for ourselves, we allow our feeling brain to try on those values for size and see what they feel like before we make the final purchase. Eventually, once we've done this enough, The feeling brain becomes accustomed to the new values and starts to believe them. Can you walk us through what that might look like? We can throw that in the worksheet for this episode.
Well, and so that's actually what I just told you about trying on the like, you know, what if my next book flops? Like, that is a experience that I tried on.
Did you write it down?
No, you just imagine. I mean, for some people, maybe it helps to write it down. But no, I just sat down and really imagined, like, what would that mean to my life? Like, how would my agent react? How would my publisher react? How would my wife react? How would my family react? How would I feel? What would it signify about my skills or talent? All these things. Like, you ask yourself all of these questions and you look for an answer that is, you basically look for a narrative or a story or a piece of meaning that, like, feels good to you. It creates essentially a better value, you know? So it's like, if my only value is to just sell an ass load of books, eventually I'm going to get knocked on my ass, because eventually I'm going to put out something that doesn't sell. But if my core value is to simply write as honestly and compellingly as I possibly can, then even if I put out something out that doesn't sell, I can still feel good about it. I can still feel like I'm a good writer. I can be proud, you know, look at my fans, my family, my friends, and still be proud of what I did.
When you're trying on these new values, how do you not catastrophize? Like, what would happen is Fernanda would leave me, my agent would stop returning my calls, my parents would say, see, I knew you were a one-hit wonder. My friends would be like, oh yeah, he wrote that one book that one time. Now he's just like some guy who's trying hard. What a loser. Like, I feel like that. Or how is this different from, like, the bullshit in The Secret, where it's like, oh, well, what's going to happen is I'm going to visualize a yacht and a Ferrari in my driveway, and that's going to happen. I mean, I feel like it's a little clear to me, but people are thinking that.
So it's the difference is with, like, the bullshit manifesting, you simply, like, it's funny because the Secret actually, gets close to something powerful, but just completely misses the mark. Mm-hmm. So The Secret is like, yeah, just visualize like a yacht and a Ferrari, and then one day the universe will conspire and give it to you.
Right.
The problem with that is that the yacht and Ferrari are simply representations of your current values. So if you're just a materialistic shithead and you visualize materialistic things, you're not actually challenging your identity. You're not changing at all. Mm-hmm. You're simply like affirming what you already care about. Like, the real power of visualization is, if you really want a yacht and Ferrari, sit down and visualize what it would be like to not want a yacht and Ferrari. What would that mean for your life? What would that mean for your friendships, your relationships, your career? Like, would you still like your job if you didn't want a yacht or a Ferrari? And that's a very scary question for a lot
of
people.
Yeah.
And it's much more difficult to answer. But that's where the real, like, identity work comes in, where you really look at the value, not just the stuff.
That's a good point, because guys in finance are sitting there going, oh yeah, I got a house in the Hamptons. I've got my kids go to this awesome private school. And it's like, okay. But if they start to challenge themselves, nobody wants to do that when they're in that job and they have what we call the golden handcuffs, right?
Yeah.
Because you can't, switching costs are too high.
Sure.
You basically have to tell your kids they can't hang out with their friends at school anymore, sell the house that your wife really loves to go to.
Yeah.
And then you have to tell your boss you don't want to do this anymore, take a massive lifestyle downgrade, and then go write books or do a shitty podcast that only a few people care about.
Yeah.
Whatever.
The ball of yarn got too rolled up.
Yeah.
You know, it got that decision that you made early in life of like, oh, I'm going to go into finance so I can get the nice car and the hot wife. Like, it's so deep in that ball of yarn that it's too daunting to dig in and reevaluate it.
Right.
Like, it would mean unraveling too much stuff. Yeah, it's hard. And then typically what happens to people in that situation is that life unravels it for them. You know, it's like something catastrophic happens. You know, they lose all their money in a market crash. Wife leaves them for the mailman, and suddenly it's their ball of yarn is unrolled for them.
Right.
And they're left with this like tiny, meager identity of like, you know, oh shit, everything I thought I was is gone. What do I have left? And then they have to like evaluate everything and then start wrapping a new ball.
Right. Which actually can be, that's the blessing in disguise people are talking about when someone's like, well, getting laid off or getting fired or getting this happened was the best thing that ever happened.
Best thing that ever happened.
And like in the moment when people told me that about like my other show and stuff, I was like, yep, you're kind of being an a-hole for even saying that. And then, but then you talk to enough credible people and they're like, no, really.
Yeah.
This, here's what happened to me and here's how it was about. And you go, okay, well, I'm not there yet. And then fast forward a year, year and a half,
yeah,
you go, oh, you're right. Because since that was unraveled for me, since the other show, which was like primarily a dating brand, got unraveled for me,
yeah,
I don't have to carry, I don't have to lug around baggage that goes like, yeah, the show has a douchey name, but trust me, it's not like the new show is able to grow faster. I'm able to focus on what I want. I don't have to make decisions based on other people's like irrational feelings and their like damaged identities.
Absolutely.
All that has been unraveled for me because frankly, usually we don't have the balls to unravel that stuff ourselves because it's a fucking mess.
It is a fucking mess. It's really, and I think some things can't be unraveled ourselves. Like some things, like it has to happen to us. That's why, like, in Subtle Art, there are four stories, personal stories that I put in the Subtle Art. And I think if you ranked the four most painful experiences of my life, it would be the four stories in Subtle Art. And I did that for a reason. I mean, the whole point of Subtle Art really was to make an argument for the importance of pain and suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're describing right now is exactly why I wanted to make that argument. But yeah, it's just, you know, girlfriend leaving me, parents divorcing, friend dying, you know, it's those are the most powerful moments in our lives because we get to rewrap our yarn. And if we just rewrap it the same way it was wrapped before, it's going to be extremely frustrating and disappointing. Like we're going to feel like it's unfair that we have to like redo everything all over again. What it really is an opportunity to like reinvent ourselves.
Right. Like shift the, what you call the God value, that tippy top value, where if it's money, we work in a Wall Street finance job like I was doing. You buy a house, you buy a boat, you buy a bunch of stuff, and then you send your kids to a fancy private school and you're like, good. But then at some point, this is like a lens through which you view the world, right?
Sure.
But you can run into this like evidence that will do nothing because that belongs to the thinking brain, as you've said.
So
what do we do? And how do we handle that? Because I think that can be a big problem for a lot of people.
So when we're adopting values for ourselves, we kind of put them in an order. Mm-hmm. You know, it's my kids are more important to me than my friends, and my friends are more important to me than random strangers on the street. And my job is more important to me than, say, my brother's job or whatever. Like we all have this kind of hierarchy of values that determines our prioritization, determines, like helps us make decisions on like where our time is best spent. In our value hierarchy, something is at the top. And I use the name God value, but it's not necessarily a religious. For a lot of people, it's a religious value. But it's whatever our top value in our life is, it basically dictates the decision-making of everything underneath it. So if my... And then, like you said, like I say in the book, like it becomes a lens by which everything else is perceived. So... Let's say I am a super religious person and my God value is like Jesus Christ, everything that occurs in my life, I will look at in terms of, and I will judge it and I will measure it in terms of my faith in Jesus Christ and the Bible and all that stuff. If my God value is money, then every experience I have in my life will be measured against the metric of money, and what gets me the most money. And so this is the funny thing, is that you can have people who are like, say, Christian, but if their God value is money, they will perceive and approach church and their religious experiences in terms of what is most profitable
for them. Yeah, you end up with prosperity gospel and stuff like that.
Exactly.
Trying so hard not to mention names, but right? Like, so tempting. Also, they have really good lawyers, so I'm going to not do that.
So it's fascinating. I mean, ultimately, what defines us is our behavior. And our behavior is defined by what our top values are. And so you can get people who say, like, oh, I care most about charity and giving back and, you know, and helping others. And it's like, if their behavior is saying otherwise, you know, it's... They might have those values somewhere on the hierarchy, but something else is on top.
Right. Yeah. They just know that they have to say that because that's what the group kind of wants to see.
Yes.
They don't want to hear about like your three private jets or whatever that they paid for when they're putting money into the hat as it goes by. And this is the part where when I read it, I was like, oh, maybe we should roll up a J and talk about this because you wrote that the conflict between values is actually kind of required for us puny humans to actually achieve.
Yes.
What is that? That's kind of like, wait, what? I want all this chaos?
Well, I think it's...
I want all this conflict? This is depressing.
The conclusion I kind of argue, and it's not my idea. It's, you know, it comes from Nietzsche and some other philosophers, but it's basically we need some degree of conflict because conflict is affirming for our values. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like if I believe... I'm trying to think of an example that's not going to offend tons of people.
Good luck. I'll wait.
Yeah. 5 minutes later.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll just cut and then fast forward like a little time lapse.
Yeah, but like, let's say, I'll use a silly example. Like, let's say I strongly believe that Stephen King is the best author of all time, and you strongly believe that J.K. Rowling's the best author of all time. Arguing with you about that, it affirms my belief in my values. It makes me feel as though I'm living out my values. Like that, the way we find meaning in life, and again, this kind of comes back to the hope thing, is like the way we find meaning in life is when we feel as though we're living out our values. It's like, okay, my kids are my highest value. If I'm taking good care of my kids, then I'm living a meaningful life. I'm doing something important. And that protects me from the uncomfortable mm-hmm. truth. If I think Stephen King is like the fucking man and anybody who disagrees is an asshole and an idiot, and I'm going to go tell them that, then telling those people is reaffirming my value. It feels meaningful to me. It feels important, and it protects me from the uncomfortable truth. So some conflict is a little bit necessary. Like it, the same way, you know, we need stress on our body to get stronger physically and like grow muscle. Like, I think psychologically we need a certain amount of stress to test our values and embody them and grow, like reap meaning from them.
Right. Like in group and out group, for example, yes. And like the us versus them, which actually is something that we see a lot right now in society. Because if yes. we don't have that tension, we have to look for it.
Yes.
Which leads us to this blue dot effect. I hadn't heard of that before, but yeah. This is great. Tell us about this.
So there was an amazing academic study that happened last year.
Oh, it's that recent?
Yeah, it
oh,
just happened last year. And it was huge in the psychology academic world. Because mm-hmm. it's like the guys who did it are like kind of an all-star team of researchers right now. So basically what they did, it sounds super boring at first, but it's pretty mind-blowing like once you understand it. So what they did is they took tons of people, put them in front of a computer console, and they showed them thousands of dots on the screen. And they said... They gave them two buttons. They say, if the dot's blue, hit this button. If the dot's not blue, hit that button. And the dots were either blue, purple, or like some shade in between. Mm-hmm. And at first, they showed tons and tons and tons of blue dots. And so people were mostly hitting the blue dot button. And then as time went on, they slowly showed fewer blue dots and started showing more purple dots or dots that were kind of ambiguous and in between. And what was fascinating is that even though they showed fewer and fewer blue dots as time went on, people still hit the blue button the same amount. So like their actual perception of what color a dot was shifted based on their expectation of how many dots there was. So that sounds really like annoying.
So freaking what?
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So what? So they did this with collected data from like thousands of people on this. Showed a very strong effect. And then what they did is they replaced the dots with human faces. So they did the same thing. They said, if the face looks threatening, hit this button. If the face looks safe or innocuous, hit this button. And initially, they showed mostly threatening faces. And so people hit the buttons. And then as time went on, they started showing fewer and fewer threatening faces. And the same thing happened. When you started removing threatening faces, people started to mistake safe and innocuous faces as being threatening. And then they went even a step further. They started doing it with research proposals. They showed unethical research proposals and ethical research proposals. And the same thing, the more you removed unethical research proposals, the more people mistook ethical proposals for being unethical. So it's basically this idea that we have this like set expectation of a certain amount of threats or pain or adversity that we psychologically expect to see. And so the safer society gets, or the more just and righteous things get, it's not like we feel better about it. We simply take, you know, it's like if people stop killing everybody, we don't actually feel better about it.
Right.
Instead, we decide that slapping somebody is just as awful as killing.
Right. And so that's how we end up here with like, well, shoot, everything's safer. So now words are violence.
Words are violence. Yeah. Looks are violence.
Microaggressions.
Microaggressions. Whatever. Questions are violence. Reading a book about racism is traumatizing. I mean, it explains so many things, like the concept creep that's been happening in our culture. I think it also explains like why, well, it explains our politics for one, but it also explains like why we're struggling so much to again create that kind of coherent mm-hmm. vision of hope for ourselves, because it's like if you know, we've got awesome lazy boy recliners and 8 million video games and right. you know, Netflix and all this like comfortable, everything can be delivered like, you know, at the drop of a hat. It's we need to find our brain like naturally looks for something that's upsetting or adversarial in our environment, even though it might not be there.
What can we do about it? I mean, is there anything that we can do about this? We can't fix society ourselves, but is there anything we can do ourselves? Like maybe we're aware of this. So then when we get offended about something, we're like, oh, am I just getting offended because there's nothing else to do? My brain is looking for this. Like, what's the practical here? Is there one?
I think it comes back to what I talked about in Subtle Art, which is we need to start choosing our problems instead of constantly feeling like they're being, because if we don't choose our problems, our brain's going to find problems for us.
Right.
And it'll find it in really stupid, obnoxious
like
places.
Worrying about how my freaking Instagram is not growing fast enough. Meanwhile,
exactly.
I'm like eating delicious sushi delivered to my house.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a perfect example.
While watching Netflix.
It's a perfect example. So it's like if we don't consciously choose our problems that give our lives meaning, then our brain is going to look for it and find it in like really silly, stupid places. And I think that essentially describes Twitter in a nutshell.
Yeah. Yeah. We just talked about this. I don't know if it was pre-show or what, but yeah, 99 interactions on Twitter, one guy's a dick. And I'm like, this whole thing is yep. a waste of time. I can't believe it. I'm going to go off on this guy. I spend 3 seconds interacting with the other 99 people who have like, your show changed my life. And I'm like, hold on. I'm talking to this guy who doesn't even follow me, yeah. who's correcting my grammar.
Yeah.
So thanks yep. anyway.
It's like that old, I don't know if it was Oatmeal or the XCDY or whatever that
yeah,
comic strip
XKCD,
was.
And
it's like the guy who's like, typing and his wife's like, come to bed. He's like, not now, honey. Someone on the internet is wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And that in a nutshell, it's funny now, but it's sort of when you extrapolate that to the rest of society, I like the takeaway of choosing our problems. I
yeah.
think there's a lot of power in that. Like
yeah.
you're not going to get rid of the problems. Choose the ones that are worth handling.
Yep.
And it's worth taking the time to figure out what that might even be in the first place.
Yep, absolutely. And I think that's actually in one of the chapters I argue that we need to redefine our idea of like freedom and liberty in terms of not freedom for more nice stuff, but freedom to choose what matters to us. Freedom, like the only freedom is found in like self-limitation and choosing like, this is the problem I want in my life. This is what I'm deciding to sacrifice myself for. Fuck all the rest. I don't need like 15 different types of food delivered to my door. I don't need to like watch every Netflix series. This is the thing I care about. And like that is true freedom.
And that's why Everything is Fucked is actually a book about hope.
A book about hope.
It really is. It's not a joke. It's a book about hope. Mark, thank you so much, man.
Thanks for having me, dude. Always a pleasure.
Always. Great big thank you to Mark Manson. His book, one of the best-selling books of the decade. It sold over 7.5 million copies as of recording, and who knows? It just could keep on going. I don't think it's even slowing down. One of the best-selling books of the entire decade. Incredible. The original book is called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. The new book is called Everything is Fucked. He likes his F-bombs in the titles. I can't argue with his success. So there we go. And they're honestly, they're great reads.
I love both of them, and Everything is Fucked is a great read as well. If you want to know how I managed to book all these great people and manage my relationships using systems and tiny habits, check out our 6-minute networking course. That course is free, and that's over at jordanharbinger.com/course. Don't say you'll do it later. Don't say you're too busy. It's 6 minutes a day, not even. And the biggest problem people have is they go, oh man, I didn't dig the well before I got thirsty. I don't have those relationships, and now I need to leverage them. You're too late when you do that. So get on it, jordanharbinger.com/course. Speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from Mark Manson. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. There's a video of this interview on our YouTube channel at jordanharbinger.com/YouTube. This show is produced in association with Podcast One, and this episode is co-produced by Jason, always looking on the bright side, DeFilippo, and Jen Harbinger. Show notes and worksheets are by Robert Fogarty. I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. Remember, we rise by lifting others. So the fee for the show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which should be in every episode. So please share the show with those you love. Share the show with those you don't. In the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on this show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time. This episode is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. As the new year rolls in, we're bombarded with messages about transforming ourselves, but how about a different approach for 2024? Let's celebrate what's already great about us. So let's talk therapy. It's a powerful tool, not just for overcoming challenges, but for recognizing your strengths and making meaningful changes. Therapy teaches you to cope positively and set sound boundaries. It's for everyone who wants to sharpen their mental well-being. So if you've been thinking about therapy, but keep giving yourself excuses not to start, here's a little nudge to give BetterHelp a try. It's completely online, tailored to your schedule. You fill out a questionnaire, get paired with a licensed therapist, and remember, you can switch therapists anytime, no extra charge.
Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/Jordan today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/Jordan.